My name is Arthur Amiot. I'm a resident of Custer, South Dakota. I was born on the Pine Ridge Indian Reservation in 1942, and I was educated in the Custer school system shortly after the close of World War II. My parents moved off the reservation to find employment, and so they moved to Custer, South Dakota. And it was there that I attended all 12 grades of high school. From there, I went to Northern State University and got my Bachelor of Art of Science degree in art education. And from there, I taught for 2 years in Sioux City, Iowa, and then I was retrieved by my alma mater and became an instructor of art education at Northern State College at that time, Northern State University, on the condition that I begin graduate school. And so I attended the University of Oklahoma and also the Penn State University and State College, and was working on my Master of Art Education degree there. And anyway, I had a disagreement with my graduate committee, so I left graduate school and returned to the reservation and re-entered the traditions and began a long career of recording ethnohistory and doing Native American art history research with elders and elder craftsmen and elder artists. And from there, I got in on the beginning of the American Indian College establishments, and I taught at Pine Ridge for about a year, and then from there I moved to Standing Rock. There was a new college formed there, and so I taught Native Studies and Native Art, and associated with the elders there in reestablishing some of the sacred traditions. And in 1980, I received a Bush Leadership Fellowship, and so I went off to the University of Montana in Missoula and studied with Joseph Epps Brown, the well-known author of the book The Sacred Pipe, co-authored it with Nicholas Black Elk of Black Elk Speaks. And anyway, from... So I received a Master of Interdisciplinary Studies in Anthropology, Native American Art History, and Native American Sacred Traditions. And from there I moved to back to Standing Rock, and then from there, shortly after, to the University of Brandon University in Brandon, Manitoba, where I was a visiting professor of Native Studies and Art. I stayed there until 1985. And then I returned home to the Black Hills to establish my studio. And since 1985, I've been pursuing my art in my own established studio. But I continued my work as a scholar in terms of writing and publishing and lecturing throughout the United States in national forums and also at national, international forums in Europe and at European museums.
Arthur Amiot, I want to say palamailo.
Oh,
thank you. Thank you so much for joining us today. It's a real honor to have you in our studio.
Thank you.
And thank you for that introduction, too. I always want to get that in your words, and that helps for posterity's sake. That introduction is important. But I want to ask a question about the early part of your career.
Mm-hmm.
And as a student, you were able to attend a workshop with Oscar Howe at Northern State University.
Yes.
And I want to ask how that influenced your work as a student, and if it still influences your work today.
Ah, most certainly. No, actually, I didn't go to Northern State intending to be an artist. I was actually going to major in biology because I loved biology so much in high school. And then I was also going to minor in English, which I did. During the first year, or the first and second semester of my first year, I found out that university-level biology was a total foreign language to me. I mean, they actually do speak biologies during the lectures, and it was a language I was totally unfamiliar with. And but I performed very well during the lab parts of the course. You know, you go to the lecture, and then another 2 hours, you sometime during the week, you go to the laboratory and look through a microscope and draw what it is that you're studying. Anyway, I did very well with my laboratory drawings. I could finally understand what the lectures were about, that if I could see it through the microscope, and also the idea of dissecting frogs. And anyway, as you move through the course, then it becomes a little bit more complex. Anyway, the semester, the quarter, I was dissecting my fetal pig in the lab and attending lectures. I was having a difficult time with the lectures, but I did really well in the labs and drawing the heart and drawing the blue veins and the red arteries and so forth on this dissected pig. Anyway, the classroom building burned down, and the laboratory burned up, and all my lab work and my lab notes were burned up, and so the only grade I had that term was the lecture grade.
Oh my goodness.
And of course the lectures were really bad grades, you know. I think I got a C or a D or something, because they weren't able to enter in my lab grade. And of course, being the goody two moccasins that I was, you know, I was an overachiever, and I became very distressed, and because I did not want to receive a bad grade, which I did. And so I went to this university, or the college counselor, and he directed me to the art department after he heard my tale of woe, you know, about my drawings getting burned up in the lab. And he thought maybe I should try an art career. And so I went to the art department, and lo and behold, the director, the head of the art department at Northern at that time, was a gentleman named William Holliday. And Holliday had been previously at Dakota Wesleyan, and this was like in the 50s. And it was while he was at Dakota Wesleyan that he had Oscar Howe as one of his students. And that's where Oscar Howe got his bachelor's degree before he went on to the University of Oklahoma at Norman, see. And so William Holliday knew Oscar Howe, and he also knew that Oscar Howe was beginning a workshop at the University of South Dakota, a summer workshop for Indian students. And it only lasted 2 weeks, but by the end of that first year, I had two drawing courses and one watercolor course. Anyway, our drawing courses had to do with anatomy and the human figure, and drawing with charcoal, and then later with pen and ink and so forth. So I had my foundation in anatomy, anatomical drawing, as it were. And, of course, I didn't have any money. I had to come home to the Black Hills and work in a restaurant during the summertime. And I told Professor Holliday that, no, I couldn't attend because I didn't have the money. He said, oh, we'll see what we can do. And I actually think he personally came up with the $300. He gave me a scholarship, I think, but he kept it discreet. I never knew who did it, but he found some money for me. And so I worked at the restaurant, and then the week before the workshop started, shortly before it started, I took the bus down to Vermilion, lived in the dorm and there were three other gentlemen and one woman from Standing Rock, and we went to class every day, and Oscar Howe inspired us, and he introduced us to Native American art of that time, which was the flat style of drawing. You had to know anatomy and you had to be able to draw, and we all did, and I had my background, and he showed us slides of his artwork and talked to us about how to abstract these figures and how to find the aesthetic points on a rectangle, you know, and then he said, go to it. And so we had to draw and then abstract the drawings, break them into flat planes the way he did, and produce our paintings. But the whole experience of being with someone who was totally convinced he was an artist, which of course he was, and he encouraged us to draw from our own tribal backgrounds, stories that we knew, legends, mythology perhaps, and things that we had personally seen back in our reservations in terms of people wearing traditional garments, dresses at dances, huh? He said, think real hard and remember what these dancers looked like that you saw. And of course, I had had that experience because I was born on the Pine Ridge Reservation, lived with my grandparents until I was 6 years old. Then I moved off the reservation with my biological parents. But every spring, as soon as school was out, I would go back to the reservation to live with Grandma and Grandpa and participate in the tribal activities that were taking place at that time. We're talking about, I started school in like 1948. And all through the 50s, and every summer after that, I'd return to the reservation and work in the gardens and ride horses and round up cattle and do all the ranch things and then also attend the tribal dances and celebrations and ceremonies and funerals and happy events as well, where traditional feasts and giveaways and people would wear their traditional garments. Anyway, I'd had that background already, so when I was in the Oscar Howe workshop, he just encouraged us to recall all those kinds of things that we knew as Lakota people, and that was to become the subject of our paintings. And so it was a very dynamic time, and he was appreciative of the things we were drawing, and he said, this is what Native American art is. And he told us about his early years at Santa Fe and working with Dorothy Dunn Kramer and the trials and tribulations he went through. But he also knew non-Indian art history as a result of his studies with Bill Holliday, see, at the Dakota Wesleyan. So, we were becoming familiar, I was becoming familiar with Western art history. So that lasted for 2 weeks, and I got the impetus, the beginnings of starting to do Native American art of that period, the flat Oscar Howe style. Huh? And I continued that, but that fall when I went back to Northern, I had to enter back into the regimen of doing typical university artwork. I had to take more drawing courses and do live drawings, anatomical drawings, and get into oil painting, and more watercolor courses. And the regimen was still lives and landscapes, things that were totally unrelated to Native culture. Huh? So I eventually became adept at doing typical white man art. But my painting instructors did not particularly like Indian art. They thought that was something that's another world, you know, that's something else. You have to learn this. Learn architectural drawing and bottles and fruit and landscapes and perspective. And it was good, you know, I enjoyed that too. And in fact, I incorporated, once you learn, for example, perspective and anatomy, it can do wonderful things with the traditional Indian painting themes and techniques. And of course, by that time, I was learning art history, and I was learning about Paleolithic art and Neolithic art, and eventually, through the ages, then you come up to modernism and cubism. And then I began thinking about what Oscar Howe was doing, you know, stylistically, And I knew that he really wasn't doing cubism, because cubism has something else to do with showing the front and back and sides simultaneously in a space-time kind of thing, and that's not what Oscar Ha was doing. He was breaking things into planes from a frontal perspective, but the dynamics of anatomy and perspective that he showed in his work, it led me to appreciate and become more analytical of Native American art. And it also encouraged me, because at the same time I was taking art education courses and new theories of creativity, you know, how I was learning how to teach teachers how to teach art, or I was learning how to teach art, but eventually I became a professor of art education, teaching teachers how to teach art. Anyway, I was very infatuated with the then contemporary theories of creativity, and also learning the biographies of other artists, you know, the classical artists, how they worked, and I became quite infatuated. And in terms of studies, the psychology of creativity, which we had to learn in terms of our art education courses, teaching children and young people art, how to foster creativity. And somehow I took it to heart that many of the theories, you better be able to practice them if you're going to preach them. So I started consciously trying out different techniques and experimenting, you know, testing my own creativity. And anyway, so that all of this was the effect that the Oscar Ha Art Workshop had on me. It led me into a career of exploration and lifelong devotion to art history and the making of art, and eventually the appreciation of Native cultures, both archaeology and historical and contemporary Native cultures. And in fact, in 1980, or actually 1969, I left university teaching and returned to the reservation to explore fully firsthand Native American traditions, and to be able to document and see. I grew up seeing people do beadwork and quill work and to make quilts and make feather work and to carve pipes and make drums and things. But I never thought of them as art. But from my new perspective as a white-trained art historian, these gained new significance for me. So I left university teaching in 69 and went back to the reservation to document and learn some of these techniques. And anyway, all of that came out of the experience with Oscar Ha.
Wow, thank you. I want to ask, listening to all this, it makes me think that you grew up biculturally in many ways. You were, you know, on the summers in
yes.
on the reservation, and during school you were, you know, in Custer.
Yes.
You went to a non-native university, a white university, but you went back to the res and sort
yes.
of got your university education from the elders in that
yes.
sense, which is appropriate.
Yes.
You've done both. Does
yes.
your artwork reflect that now? Is it a combination of both?
Yes, it is. In fact, compositionally and media-wise, what I'm doing in collage, I mean, collage is a totally non-Indian technique and movement. You know, it began with the Dadaists, you know, in Germany, and then it preceded the Surrealists, and then there were Surrealists, but even Picasso, you know, did, and Matisse, you know, and these... George Braque, you know, they did collages, the first experimental contemporary collages. But as an art educator, it's also one of the things we teach to fifth grade students, you know, taking bits and pieces and pasting them together and trying to make sense out of them compositionally. But it was the training in composition and design and technique, which is very non-Indian. And actually, some of the content of the collages that I make are non-Indian. Historic photographs, antique magazine ads, advertisements, and as I say, the historic photographs. But what what comes through as tradition is the message of the content, the voice of the people who are undergoing the changes represented in the collages. That is the worldview of the Lakota as they are viewing this changing world that they're participating in. And of course, technically, the technique of doing hard edges in the painting is a traditional Lakota technique of painting. And that's something I learned in the Oscar Howe workshop, the idea of making images with fine, hard edges, sometimes with just lines, contour lines. It constitutes an image. And but the application of the pigment itself to the surface, that is a very traditional painting technique, because when the historical people painted on hide, they had to be very decisive in the kind of edge that the hue, the color, was, because you can't erase once you paint. if you've owned a suede vest or a suede skirt or a suede purse, you know, you could just kill yourself when you touch it with a pen, you know, because that mark is going to be there forever. It's you can't remove it. And so painting on hide, you had to have a pre-image of what it was you were going to paint. You couldn't sketch on it the way you do on paper before you do a drawing. You have to have that image in your head and be technically sophisticated enough to, when you make that mark on that buckskin, that has to be the final mark of that image. And likewise, applying the paint, it has to be put on in flat planes, because there was no chiaroscuro, no going from light to dark in the traditional painting technique. And so you need to be able to technically be masterful of the technique and your medium. Now, that is very traditional, coming from the culture. And I use those techniques in making the collages. Once I get the, in quotes, the non-Indian materials of paper and photographs laminated and conceptualizing them into this composition, once I get that laid down, then the traditional painting technique takes over, because then I go back and repaint everything in the collage, retinting certain photographs and adding the fine edges. In fact, the sides and the bottom edges are sometimes framed with a color, and those are hand painted straight lines that go straight across the edge of the painting. So it's a combination of non-Indian content, but Native American technique and worldview presented by the whole composition.
Thank you. And the non-Native content that you pull from ranges in time, I understand, from about 1870 to about 1930, if that's right.
Yes.
Old images, old advertisements, old documents.
Yes.
Why that period? Why is that important to you?
Well, there is a stereotype that has occurred in America about Native Americans. Everybody seems to be aware of the historical period, the Dances with Wolves period, huh? Or the historical period represented in the old 1950s Western movies, huh? About the Indians living in teepees and hunting buffalo and attacking wagon trains and the Indians hunting buffalo. Anyway, that prehistoric or pre-reservation history has been mythologized, it has been analyzed, it has been written about, it has been romanticized, not only by non-Indian tea people, but by some Indian people as well. Anyway, the stereotype is somehow that we were these historic warriors, buffalo hunting people living in teepees, and then the reservation started. And then all of a sudden, we're modern Indian people with all these social dilemmas, huh? And nobody seems to pay attention to the period of the Great Transition. How did these people live once they got on the reservation? What changes took place? What did they have to endure, and what did they have to adapt to? And it's actually a marvelous story of people leaving behind, living in one place, leaving behind the old roaming days, the buffalo hunting days. The confrontation was over. The bison had been decimated. And the native people, in a very desperate period of time, had to either adapt or die. Your choice was you either adapted to these new living conditions technologically, educationally, spiritually, because Christianity was imposed, superimposed, and education and Christianity kind of went hand in hand because the missionaries, you know, were the first in charge of the education systems. And all of this was in agreement with the federal government policy to radically change these native people into white people, make them successful farmers and ranchers, capitalists, independently owning pieces of the land, you know, to get rid of all the senses of tribal identity, which was a communality and a spiritualism, you know, a vast cosmic view of the world and man's role in it. And tribal inclusion of your of others in your identity. I'm a part of something bigger and greater, which is the people. Anyway, changing from those kinds of sensibilities into becoming modern, technologically sophisticated capitalists. You know, but the whole period from 1870, the beginning of the reservation period, up until about 1930, is a dynamic time in the history of the people. And these were the people that I grew up knowing, these elders who had been through that and who had made successful adaptations, people who knew how to handle cows and to horses and horse-drawn we still went around in a horse and wagon right up till 1964 on the reservation. I mean, this is after I had graduated from college. People at Pine Ridge were still going about in horses and wagons as I had throughout my childhood, huh? And anyway, so the whole idea of adaptation, the immense stress that it put people under, yet they creatively went to it and adapted. Anyway, they raised huge gardens and switched diets, you know, planting potatoes and corn and beans and squash, and the ladies learned to can and make preserves in addition to the traditional drying of traditional foods, wild foods, huh? And instead of freezing meat in the freezer, which they didn't have, they continued to dry the meat as jerky and store it for the winter. And so it was a combination of tradition and new learned approaches to survival. And the whole idea of living in wooden houses, first they had log houses with dirt roofs and dirt floors, and eventually they began putting in wooden floors and wooden ceilings and shingled roofs, and they built log structures for their cattle, you know, like low-slung barns for the winter time, storing corn and making haystacks to feed their cattle during the winter time, and the ladies mastering the sewing machine to make garments, and the whole change, I mean, having houses with furniture and beds, you know, but they continued to pitch the teepees and the other kinds of tents in the yard so that they could sleep out in the summertime. And anyway, they made all these adaptations while still retaining certain historical traditions as well and synthesizing them into a modus operandi that became a fine means of survival and transition into the modern era, because electrification actually doesn't come to the reservation until the late 50s. Homes become electrified, and then by that time many more people are also able to own vehicles, automobiles. But it all happens very late on the reservation. For example, in the 40s and mid-50s, there was a minority of people who owned automobiles and trucks. But by the mid-60s and 70s, almost everybody did, and all the homes were electrified, had electricity. And so it's a story of change and adaptation. And now I've forgotten where we were.
This is very good stuff.
But what I'm saying is it's an amalgamation or a synthesis, a hybrid of both cultures, cultures of survival. But most important in this synthesis is the persistence of the sacred traditions. And it's the sacred traditions of the ceremonies, the sun dance, the vision quest, the name-giving ceremonies, the celebration of moving from one stage in life to another, the funerary practices. Some of those became synthesized with Christianity, but others retained their historical, non-synthetic qualities. And it's those that I was most familiar with because my family did retain many of the traditional aspects of Lakota life and belief. And that has fascinated me as a scholar. And it also inspired me to go back and participate in these very traditional modes of expressing spirituality. And that impressed me so much that when I did go home to Pine Ridge, I stayed there for almost 6 years, and from there I moved to Standing Rock, where I worked with the elders there also, and became familiar with the persistence of ancient, unsynthetic sacred beliefs. And they have continued to inspire me as a scholar. And oddly enough, it's this material that has become the content of contemporary coursework now at many of our own tribal community colleges and universities that have Native Studies programs. The whole area of changing Native belief systems is now you can take courses in it, and there are numerous texts that have been written and biographies of Native people contemporary Native people who have undergone these sacred traditions, you know, people like Frank Fool's Crow, you know, and of course Black Elk and the Sacred Pipe, and numerous publications, in addition to publications on Native art. we've seen a proliferation since probably beginning in the mid-70s. There has been a proliferation of media treating the historical arts of Native people, and also of the Native American religions and spirituality. All of these have become commonplace now in modern media. But it has always been an inspiration for me to have undergone them at some point in my life, and to see the progression of how these two areas of Native life have come to the forefront now in terms of modern developments in the arts and spirituality.
That point of you draw from for your art from 1870 to 1930, that was a turning point in history of Indigenous peoples in the Dakotas. But another turning point that I think you lived through was the early 1970s, when you were first becoming a professor. Mm-hmm. And of course the rise of the American Indian movement, a renaissance in many ways of a spirituality. It wasn't until 1976, I believe, that Native Americans could legally practice their own religion. While they were practicing it, they couldn't legally do it. So that point in history is also, I think, something that you took part in. You helped found all the stuff you're talking about in the movement.
Yeah.
Am I wrong?
Well, actually, there always was a subculture There always was a subculture in the 40s, the 50s, the 60s, a native subculture of believers and practitioners. It's just that they did not do it terribly overtly. Now, at Pine Ridge, though, for many, many years, they did have an annual Sundance, but it was a part of the old country harvest festival, too, you know, that was predominant throughout the plains, the annual fair. And a part of the, at Pine Ridge and Rosebud, they had the annual Pine Ridge Fair and the Pine Ridge, or the Rosebud Fair, and people would gather and, initially in the 20s and 30s, they would bring in produce and they would compete by showing the biggest pumpkin that someone raised or the best potato or the finest calf, you know. But they also had homemaking competitions. There was competitions in quilt making, and but there was also canning competitions, baking competitions, the best kind of bread and the best kind of jellies and jams. But there was always a place, especially during the Collier period in the 30s, the encouragement of Native American traditional arts. The Indian Arts and Crafts Board was founded in the 30s. And so there was also competition with the beadwork and quill work and traditionally made items. But simultaneously, a part of that, and the government allowed people to come and camp and participate in those things, and the emergence of the rodeo, see. But it was also a time for them to express their spirituality. And one of the things that happened at Pine Ridge was they, in the morning hours before noon, they would have enactments of the Sundance, so the first half of the day they'd start out with a version of the traditional Sundance, but then it had to end at noon because the missionaries were there and the priests didn't like it and people were objecting to it, so they would do it in the morning, and then they would. At noon it would end, and then the area where they were doing this became what we think of today as the powwow grounds, where social dancing took place. Huh? But it was a way of accommodating this subculture of believers that were carrying on the sacred traditions. And in time, and this happened probably about the mid-70s, there was an uprising. And it wasn't just the native activists from the urban areas. It wasn't just the AIM people. There were also native people who had become educated in universities, who were returning to the reservation, and who knew about what Christianity had done to native people in the past. And they became somewhat activists, too, and helped sponsor pure Sundances, That didn't they would go all day, and they were just sacred. There was no longer this fair atmosphere, you know, with stands at Soul Food and Ferris wheels and merry-go-rounds and rodeos. You know, they became increasingly more sacred, and just for that purpose. And out of that, then in 1976, the Freedom of Religion Act then gave Native people the right to say, we don't have to disguise this anymore, and we don't have to synthesize it. We don't need the blessing of the churches or Christianity anymore. These are our belief systems. We can do these things. And that's something that I participated in, when especially with the Standing Rock people. They wanted to revive their historical Sundance, and so as something I think of it as being a cultural animateur, someone who helps animate the culture from within, And I wasn't afraid of the devil. I wasn't afraid of being castigated by the church or anybody. I felt quite competent that these are our beliefs and we have a right to express them, and I didn't have to synthesize them, you know, and that was as pretty much from the perspective of an academic scholar also, because I was also very familiar with the literature, anthropology and historical literature on the sacred tradition, see. And anyway, so that's, there were, it wasn't just activists, it wasn't AIM people. There were, these things arose from Native people coming back to their own tribes after having received education in the broader world. For a brief time, there was this activism, you know, the Wounded Knee too, and all that. But basically, the founding of our own tribal colleges took place at this time. And that's where these kinds of studies and considerations of the culture and our sacred belief systems, all these became parts of the curriculum, huh? And so the founding of the colleges also helped bring about this awareness, you know, and cultural revival, because people were critically thinking now about the culture. It wasn't just left up to the BIA or the white education systems on the reservations, because most of the BIA schools were still white-oriented. Very few of them taught the language or Native studies, huh? Anyway, it was also during the late 70s when Native studies, and anyway, as a result of that, many of the parochial schools changed their attitude, where before they had prohibited the language because it was the missionaries who initially preserved the language so that they could translate religious texts into Native languages to convince people, you know, to become Christians in their own language. Well, then the languages took off, and they began teaching them as reading and writing, you know, and in some cases speaking. In addition to that, the community colleges began teaching Native language courses as well, you know, academically. And some even created immersion systems, you know, for college-age people to learn the language. And then this translated then, in some cases, into the public schools or BIA schools on reservations, huh? And the whole idea of teaching Native art, because that's what happened in 1969. I participated in that program because I left my university teaching system and went back. Of course, that was the time of Title I, and Title I, I think, was the education. Title I, Title III, whatever the case is.
Sorry.
Anyway, I in 1969, I left my university system because the Bureau of Indian Affairs was very interested in teaching Native art to Native students in BIA schools, so I pioneered that effort as well, and wrote a 5-volume series of children's textbooks on Native art and instituted teaching programs and teaching Native students Native art history, but this was all from a Lakota perspective. Yeah. Does that answer your question?
Yes, thank you so very much. It's an important time in history as well, and that's why I wanted to ask you about it. But if I can switch gears a little bit, as a Wasichu journalist and a non-Native journalist, the elders that I've been able to interview over the years, one thing I've heard time and time again is the importance of humor in Lakota culture, that it plays an important role in the culture. Mm-hmm. And I want to ask about humor in your own work. Does it play a role in your work as well?
Yes, I think there are humorous aspects, but I think the humor that comes out in my work is not the ha ha ha, that's funny. I think it's more satire, perhaps, and more irony. And it's on a level that may cause you to appreciate it because the nuance is subtle. And sometimes in a naive expression, there's humor also, because the voice that's making the statement is essentially expressing a truth, you know, expressing a truth, But it's antithetical to the dominant culture. And so the truth that is being stated may cause one to chuckle a little bit because it's so antithetical to the status quo, huh? And yet it's a perspective coming from a traditional native person, huh? And there's one little painting that's in the exhibit. Anyway, I have a row of pictographic drawings. And then I have a picture of my great-grandfather, and it's repeated, the same image over and over again. Now, the pictographic images, they kind of look alike, but each one is a little bit different. You know, it has a different kind of nose, and it has a different name glyph on it. But at first glance, they look like they're similar. I mean, they look like they're the same. And then we have contemporary reflections on powwows. You know, all the fancy dancers, their outfits are all very different, but structurally they have the same components, huh? And the men's traditional, you know, and all the jingle dress dancers are wearing jingle dress dance, you know. Anyway, the statement that goes with that is some people think all Indians look alike. Sometimes we do, and sometimes we don't, you know. Anyway, it's little reflections and juxtapositions of perspectives, sometimes from within the culture, sometimes from outside the culture, are included in the... Mm-hmm. Let me point this out.
You've got a book here and showing me... Oh, yes, this piece. Yes, thank you. This piece you were just talking about. Mm-hmm. Wow. Yeah.
And then throughout the others...
And this is from the book, just for the folks on the radio, if they want to look at the book, the name here is... go ahead.
It's the catalog to the exhibition. Mm-hmm. And it's composed of... I composed it and selected I selected the three parts of it. There are two essays by me where I explore the historical work of my great-grandparents, because great-grandfather was an artist, a traditional artist. And there is an article, or one chapter, is by Lewis Warren, a well-known, respected historian, who has written a profile of my family, of my great-grandfather and his Austrian wife, and my grandmother and her two sisters, and my mother's generation. And then there is an appraisal, a documentation, and a discussion of my own collages by Janet Catherine Burlow, who is a preeminent, internationally known art historian. Anyway, the catalog itself, I think of the catalog as the voice of the exhibition. The exhibition itself is the face, and the catalog is the voice. If you read the catalog, you'll come to understand the collages, because the catalog documents. And it actually won the Independent Publishers Gold Medal for Fine Arts, the National Award for Excellence.
Oh, and that is a transformation in continuity in Lakota culture, the collages of Arthur Amiot, 1988 to 2014, in case anyone out there is interested.
It will be available from the gift shop at the Dahl Fine Arts Center during the exhibition. And a close perusal of the other artworks that are in the exhibition. If you get the catalog and you take it home and examine some of the images of the collages, then you'll be able to once again get nuances of the humor that is inherent in some of the works. And some of the works are not humorous. Some of them are statements about the dynamics of culture change. And just... but done without rancor, done without bitterness, done without anger. You know, they're simply historical perspectives on what was happening at that time. And I one humorous aspect that one aspect of the collages that people might think of as being humorous are the traditionally portrayed people riding in the old-fashioned automobile. And it is kind of, you look at it and you just have to smile because, but there's a precedent for Indian people riding in old-fashioned automobiles because there are historic photos. And the old-fashioned automobile, when it first came to the reservation, there are many stories surrounding Indian people adapting to that machine, huh? There are stories about not understanding the machine and not being able to make it stop. And so they go round and round and around in a circle till they use up all the gas, and then they're able to finally get out of this stopped vehicle. But it's also one of those technological phenomena that causes native people to become ever creative, because when the first automobiles that were available to native people were not new ones. They were usually second-hand automobiles. And the creativity with which Indian mechanics were able to substitute other parts and materials to keep these machines going, huh? And borrowing parts from different brands and somehow finding ways to put them together. You know, there's wonderful humorous stories about how this machine evolved and the kinds of things that they did to it, you know. And even Andrew Standing Soldier, who painted in the 30s and 40s and 50s, actually, shows, you know, the idea of the team of horses pulling the automobile that's stuck in the mud. You know, they had to go back to their own traditional animals to make this machine survive, you know. And on another level, I included in many of the collages as a symbol of culture change. You've heard the expression being taken for a ride. You know what that means. Well, in a sense, because non-Indian white culture dominated and the intent was to change Indian culture to become white, huh? In a sense, the whole native culture has been taken for a ride, huh? And so the automobile and the people in it actually represent what has happened to Lakota culture. In order to survive, it has had to adapt to this technology, the technologies of the non-Indian culture in time. And now we have, of course, native people who are sophisticated users of modern communication technology. In fact, all the young people now on reservations all have iPhones, you know. But you can trace the development once things become electrified, first to the, they had battery-operated radios, but radio and then television, and the effects that all of mass media has on marginal cultures, huh? And this is global. We've seen what this has done all over the globe to ancient cultures. And just the light bulb, huh? Itself has changed night into day and causes culture changes. Anyway, but the whole idea of humor being a part of my work, it's also another reflection on stepping back and seeing how these things have affected the culture. And when you look at it from that perspective, sometimes you can become very amazed, and as opposed to becoming distraught over these kinds of changes, I prefer to see it as an expression of creativity, while still retaining one's humanity.
Oh, thank you. If you have time, I'd like to just ask you a couple more questions. Mm-hmm. I really do want to thank you again for your time. If I can, I'd like to ask you about your choice to live in the Black Hills. And if this place that you came from is reflected in your art, and how place relates to your art.
Actually, the Black Hills do not find their the Black Hills do not find their I don't use much imagery for the Black Hills in my work. Now, I live in the Black Hills because at the end of World War II, as you know, the Indian population had outgrown the reservation resources. People had a longer lifespan, and families were becoming larger. First, let's go to the turn of the century, either the 1890 or the 1900 census of the entire native population in the United States. The census, now I'm sure there were people who weren't counted, but the official census for those years, 1895 or 1890 or 1900, it's around only 250,000 native people in the whole United States. And so we're talking about just the Sioux reservations, huh? People had died of, the reservation population from the beginning of the reservation in 1870 up until 1900. Great percentages of the native population disappeared. They died from disease and malnutrition and numerous, because, you know, there were epidemics of diseases. And then, of course, the drought of 1885 and 1890. That caused not just native people to die, but a lot of settlers and frontier people died at that time too, because of starvation and malnutrition and just the harshness of life. And so, one of the things, see, the traditional Native American family, the ideal for the Lakota, the ideal family was 2 to 4 children. In traditional times, because life was difficult and you couldn't have lots of children because the woman had all that work to do and her female relatives, you know, had to help with, I mean, tanning hide, moving the teepee, preparing meat and so forth. And so the ideal family was 4. If you had 4 children, you had a pretty good-sized family, huh? Then if they had spouses, you know, that increased it to 8 people. And then if they had offspring, then that. You know. The Cheyenne people, the ideal family was 2. And these traditional families, some of which had maybe 4 children, 3 children, if your children got sick and died, your family disappeared, you know, because you needed these children to keep the elders alive. So one of the phenomena that occurs after 1900 is the increase in the size of native families. Like my great-grandfather and great-grandmother had 4 children. The boy died in infancy. But the 3 daughters, one was born in, my grandmother and her 2 sisters, one was born in 1892, 1895, and my grandmother was born in 1898. And as they grew to young womanhood in 1910 and 1915 and so forth, the admonition was that you have more children. And my grandmother had 10 children, and her sister had 10 children, and her oldest sister had 8, some of which died in infancy. But the whole idea of consciously having more children, of course you could support them too, because in the new setting, you know, you could live in houses and raise your own garden produce and your meat, and so it was possible to have a larger family. However, after by the time the 3rd generation came along, the reservation, of course, land had been allotted. And the allotted land was individually owned and worked. Anyway, it could not support a very large population. So after World War II, Many of these young soldiers who had experienced life outside the reservation, and many Native women during World War II worked off the reservation, like Rosie the Riveters, huh? And they worked off the reservation. And so the established order came that the reservation lifestyle cannot, we don't have enough room for you. You're going to have to find a life off the reservation. And so many did. They moved off theirs, but in proximity. Now, see, here's the other thing we talked about earlier. I didn't just go back in the summer times, but our families were back and forth throughout the year. We'd go back at Christmas time and during funerals and weddings and birthdays. If you lived in close proximity, plus your relatives would come up and live with you part time in Custer or Rapid City, and then Hot Springs, and then some of them would go back and live on the reservation. And some of your kids would go back and live with them and for a while, then they'd come back, and so we had dual residency, you know, and so it wasn't just. You lived off the reservation and forgot about your Indianness. You were constantly in touch with your relatives, moving back and forth, some coming and living with you for a while and then back and forth. So it was a very mobile society, and in that way you continued to be able to speak the language, practice the traditions, stay in contact with your nuclear family and your extended family, and anyway, so the idea of off-reservation residency was a natural progression and a practical one, too, because then our Native people who lived off the reservation learned trades, and some of them continued on into higher education, and some of their children grew up in non-Indian schools, as I did, and were able to make the adaptation by attending university. In fact, it's the fourth generation, my generation, the greater number of the fourth generation have attended university now, and it has been, and it's this generation that who are now in their 70s, 60s, 70s, and some early 80s, who have helped transform the culture and do those kinds of things that I spoke of previously, going back and bringing back this new kind of expertise and becoming instigators, as it were, of continuing traditions. So the idea of my parents chose Custer, and it was Black Hills, and it's close to Harney Peak, and all of the acknowledging that the Black Hills were the ancestral homeland of our people, the sacred land of our people. In fact, my grandmother said, told my mother and her other children, go live in the Black Hills. It's a good place to live. Plus, we still own it. It's our homeland. You go live there. Because our people have always lived there or had something to do with it. And so that's where you should live. And the fact that I live just down the hill from Harney Peak, you know, Harney Peak is considered it's considered the sacred center of the world, and it's spoken of in Black Elk Speaks by John Neihardt, huh, and Nicholas Black Elk. So in a ideological sense, I live there because it's a choice, plus it is our sacred land, you know, and to live there is a privilege, albeit I don't necessarily agree with all the cultural surroundings that I have to live with, but at least there's a presence there of the Lakota people. They still reside in the Black Hills and think of it as a place of importance.
Thank you so much. An artist's legacy is often is really his or her own work, and your work is hanging in museums around the world. It will speak to future generations. But I want to ask, in your own words, what is your legacy? How would you like to be remembered in your own words?
Oh my goodness, that is a tough question.
I'm sorry to ask it, but me it's important to
catch. No, for a long time. because I've had such a varied career as an educator, as a scholar, as a writer, as a participator in sacred traditions. My family have sponsored many ceremonies and have had many giveaways, but I've also have a considerable record as an academic, as a scholar, having taught many students. For a long time, I resisted thinking of myself as an artist. I think because of the various kinds of things I've done, from making artwork to writing to teaching to assisting the people in fostering the traditions, I used to say, I'm not any of these, I'm all of them, but most important, I'm a good son, I'm a good uncle, I'm a good father, I'm a good Lakota man who does all these things. Anyway, my aspiration was to be able to live up to the tribal ideals of having done those things that a man should be doing. Now I'm not physically adept. I don't ride broncs, and I'm not a cowboy, and I'm not an athlete. But in my realm of thinking, to have participated in traditional activities, to have been an accomplished artist and an accomplished author, I guess these are kind of wussy things, but they're for my kind of person who is one inclined toward education. To have become accomplished in all of these various disciplines or activities is what I think defines myself, at least to me. I would like to think that because I've done these things, that I've emerged as a good old grandpa now. At the age of 73, I can make my claim to eldership, and to have been to be a good old person is one who has done all these things, I think, has been my goal in life, and I'm glad to have lived long enough to have done some of these things.
Mr. Arthur Amiot, thank you so much for your time. Pala Mailo, we really appreciate you coming into the studio and talking with us today.
Thank you very much for having me, and I do hope that people will get to the Dolphin Arts Center. The opening is on October 16th, and we'll see you there.
We'll definitely be including all of that on the website, too, with the full information where people can go and how they can get there. And at the end of the radio broadcast, we'll point people to that so they can find more information.
Very fine.
Comes that. Mm-hmm. Is there anything I'm missing that I should be asking you? Is there anything that I missed in my line of questioning, another line that we should talk about?
I don't know, other than I would say throughout my history here in the state as an original member of the South Dakota Arts Council, I have made many friends throughout South Dakota in all the major eastern towns of Aberdeen and Watertown, Huron, Brookings, Mitchell, Sioux Falls, Vermilion, Chamberlain, and certainly on the reservations, the Standing Rock Reservation, Cheyenne Eagle Butte, Lower Brule, Rosebud, Pine Ridge. I would hope that anybody hearing this exhibition, and if you remember me from our past association, that I hope you'll if you haven't seen this exhibit already, that you will try to see it sometime during its duration, because this is essentially the my swan song. There's never going to be an exhibit like this again, and I've grown old and tired, and there's not going to be another Amiot exhibit beside this one. And I hope to keep making art and perhaps exhibit periodically, but it'll never be. Oh, I might say that this particular exhibit is actually the first and last time it'll ever be seen in South Dakota, because pieces, originals, have been borrowed from different parts of the country, and they will be returned to their owners, and they will never be gathered in one place again. This is the last time that you'll ever see the entire collage series in one place.
Well, if you'll indulge me, one more question on that. This exhibit coming up at the Doll starting on October 16th, one, why is it important that your work is shown here in the Black Hills to folks here? And what do you hope it says, especially to young people, to the next generation of artists, if I can ask that? I know that's a big, giant question to throw in here at the end, but I hope that's okay.
Well, the Black Hills area, western South Dakota, is the place that is in closest proximity to all of the reservations upon which I have worked at some time in my life. You know, I've done lectures and workshops and have been in residence, have taught at their colleges and so forth. So the whole idea of West River being in proximity to Native people is very important. And to have the exhibit here, plus Rapid City, as you know, has one of the largest Native American populations of any city in the state. And many of our people who live in Rapid City have a similar story to mine in terms of having lived on the reservation and off the reservation, and can identify with the content of this exhibit. In addition to that, over the years, I have had a great deal of support. Many of the collectors of my art are from western South Dakota. Kay Reardon, Stuerwald, who was the former concessionaire at Mount Rushmore, collected my work, and the greater part of that collection has been given to the Crazy Horse Museum in Custer, the Crazy Horse Mountain. And so those are older originals exist there. Plus the Sioux Indian Museum, which is now housed at the Journey Museum, has a large collection of Amiot originals from the early days. And many of the collectors of my most recent work over the years are from Rapid City. And so having it in Rapid City is... Now, I, for one, do not claim Rapid City as my home. I'm from Custer, and I happen to have my views about Rapid City as being a home, and it's not mine. Mine is Pine Ridge and Custer. So, but the whole idea is that, no, this is a significant place. And I think over the years, we have seen remarkable young people graduating from Red Cloud. I have a special relationship with Red Cloud School over the years. They have the other largest part of my collection of my artwork. Them and Chamberlain. The Oktaw Lakota Museum owns another large collection. And, of course, USD owns a number of works. And Brookings, the Memorial Art Center. But the South Dakota matrix is where essentially the heart of my career lies, you know, in terms of the number of pieces exist in western South Dakota. But what I was going to say is that over the years, we've seen young people emerging from the Red Cloud School and indeed the Rapid City schools. There are young Indian people who move on and have fine careers. And there is an arts community of Native American artists here in Rapid City, many of whom are colleagues and people that I've associated with over the years. And I respect them very much for having chosen art as their vocations. And so the idea of continual evolving of our young people emerging from this synthesis of on and off reservation life while still retaining their Lakota worldview and values. I have a great deal of admiration for the young people who succeed. And my message would be that hopefully from these kinds of events, where Native people and non-Native people can come and see these kinds of works, that just hopefully it might inspire some of the young people, you know, to become more knowledgeable about their past histories and potentially gain a little bit of impetus in their own personal lives and careers, because we can never underestimate the influence of significant Native people on young people, just as Oscar Howe and my grandparents and my great-grandparents and other mentors in Native culture have inspired me to pursue my dream and my vision. I think our young people need to look toward these kinds of resources and maybe these kinds of exhibits and associating with other arts people in the community. Maybe it'll be an inspiration to them.
Again, Palomilo, thank you so much for your gracious time.
Well, thank you for having me.